Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Audra, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. And today's program is being done in collaboration with the Gastric Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care. And the title of today's program is Advances in the Treatment of Gastric Cancer. Today's program is supported by a grant from Genentech. We really want to thank them for their support of this program. I just want to say a few things about the program itself. We have over 115 participants on this program today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Lebanon, Lithuania, the Philippines, Romania, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is a global call, and we're delighted to have all of you on the call today. And now it is my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mohamed Bassam Sanbal. And Dr. Sanbal is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic School of Medicine, Senior Associate Consultant, Division of Hematology, Oncology, Gastrointestinal Cancer Program, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, Phoenix, Arizona. And Dr. Sanbal will be addressing overview of gastric cancer, including diagnosis and staging, current standard of care, including chemotherapy, new treatment approaches and the role of targeted treatment and immunotherapy, and precision medicine, predicting response to treatment. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sanbal.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you, everyone. It's always a pleasure to be back to this program. It's really fascinating. I've been joining this for the last, I think, at least 4 years, and there's been a lot of positive changes in gastric cancers over the last few years. So as Carolyn mentioned, we'll first talk about an overview of the gastric cancer along with some of the risk factors, how to diagnose it, and briefly how to treat it. So gastric cancer or stomach cancer is relatively really uncommon in the U.S. It's not like colon cancer or prostate cancer. Although it's uncommon, it's estimated to be about 30,000 patients every year are diagnosed with gastric cancer in the U.S. However, if we look globally in the world, it's actually it is more common in other areas in the world, such as like East Asia and some places in South America. Even if you look at the 21st century versus the 20th century, the gastric cancer incidence has decreased significantly, and that's really related to multiple reasons. One of the main reasons, which is related to the risk factors, is people are smoking less. So smoking is one of the risk factors. Alcohol is one of the risk factors. And also, most importantly, we know from multiple studies that the older ways of preserving food, such as the salt preservation, which has been now, decreased, it has decreased a lot because of the availability of refrigeration compared to the beginning of the 20th century. This has decreased, the availability of refrigeration has decreased the incidence of gastric cancer. The other risk factor, also one of the other risk factors, is an infection with a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori, or also known as H. pylori. Now, H. pylori is a very common bacteria, and a lot of people are actually walking in the street and they're infected with the bacteria and they don't even know about it. It doesn't cause problems for most people, but in some people, it actually can lead to a chronic stomach inflammation, and subsequently on the long term can cause gastric cancer. So it is one of the risk factors. And there are also some hereditary genetic risk factors that lead to stomach cancer. Stomach cancer in terms of symptoms, it varies and it depends on the location. If the cancer is located in the stomach itself, we see symptoms related to early satiety, which is really the patient saying that whenever they eat only a few bites, they feel full. And then another thing we also look for is if there is any signs of bleeding, and that's usually manifested by dark stool or sometimes even streaks of blood in the stool, which is not as common. Mostly we see dark stool. And then weight loss can happen, and if the cancer is located in the connection between the stomach and the esophagus, then sometimes patients have a symptom, we call it dysphagia, which is really problem swallowing in these patients in general. And usually any of these symptoms lead patients to kind of go to seek help from their primary care physician or their gastrointestinal doctor or the GI physician. And one of the first steps in the diagnosis is really to do an EGD or an upper endoscopy, which is like a colonoscopy, but instead of a lower endoscopy, it's an upper endoscopy going down the mouth and then the esophagus with a small tube and with a camera and looks into the stomach and then takes a biopsy of the suspicious lesion in the stomach. And then the biopsy is sent to the pathologist who would read it and confirm that there is a diagnosis of a stomach cancer. And usually here, when the patient is diagnosed with stomach cancer, we really usually recommend to kind of seek help and preferably second opinion in a tertiary center where they treat a lot of gastric cancer, because as you will hear, the treatment really varies and it really needs the multidisciplinary team approach. It needs a center where they have a tumor board for gastric cancer, where a group of doctors of GI doctors, medical oncologists, surgeon, and nutritionists, radiation oncologists, they all sit together and come up with a plan. So first step of staging is upper endoscopy, and then the patient would need a PET CT scan. And the PET scan is like a CT scan, but they inject a radioactive glucose to kind of determine where the cancer is in the body and to ask the main question, which is, has the cancer spread outside the stomach and the lymph nodes surrounding it or not? If the cancer has spread, then to other parts like the liver and distant lymph nodes or bones, we call it a stage 4 disease. If not, then that's a cancer that's localized, or we call it locoregional. So if it is locoregional only in the stomach and the lymph nodes surrounding it, then usually the patient is referred back to the GI doctor to get another special endoscopy. It's called endoscopic ultrasound, which is they go down again with a camera down the mouth, down to the esophagus and the stomach, and that camera has a special feature that it has an ultrasound in it to kind of determine how much the cancer is involving the wall of the stomach or the connection between the stomach and the esophagus. And then after that, they determine what we call the T and N stage, so T for tumor and N for lymph nodes. And then depending on that also, there is a conversation, and the patient, a lot of times, they would see a surgeon to do a very small surgery or a procedure. It's called diagnostic laparoscopy, which is going into the abdominal wall or the abdominal, into the abdominal cavity through the abdominal wall, with small incisions and cameras. They push fluids into the abdominal cavity, and then they suck the fluids out, and then they examine it under the microscope to make sure that there is no cancer in the abdominal cavity or in the lining of the abdomen. That's what we call the peritoneal staging. And then if we determine that the cancer has not spread to the peritoneum, then again, the tumor board would discuss with each other kind of what the next step in the treatment. For most patients whose cancer have not spread, the treatment is usually a combination of surgery plus minus chemotherapy. Most patients would require chemotherapy And the chemotherapy that we use with this cancer is called FLOT chemotherapy, which is a combination of three different chemotherapies. Now, this is for the majority of the patients with gastric cancer who have the majority of the patients who has gastric cancer. The minority, though, which is about 15 to 20% of localized or local regional gastric cancer, they have changes in their cancer and they have specific changes in the cancer itself. It makes it very sensitive to immunotherapy, new drugs that are available. And so that phenomena, the changes in the proteins that makes them sensitive, it's called MMR deficiency or MMR deficient tumor, or also known as MSI high. So these cancers are actually not treated with chemotherapy. They're treated with immunotherapy plus surgery. Now, if it is a metastatic disease, then that's when precision medicine is very important. You know, over the last years, there are some specific proteins we test for. There are four major proteins we test for. We call them biomarkers. There is the MMR that I discussed, which is done on the tissue itself. And if the patient has MMR deficient disease, in the metastatic setting, that happens in about only 5%. Then the treatment is with immunotherapy. Again, those are drugs that given intravenously activate the immune system to go and fight the cancer. If and then we also look if the cancer has another protein, a different protein called HER2 or HER2, then the treatment would be chemotherapy plus another drug that targets the HER2. It's called trastuzumab. We also look at another protein called PD-L1. If the PD-L1 is positive and the HER2 is positive, we do chemotherapy plus the trastuzumab plus pembrolizumab. Pembrolizumab is an immunotherapy. If the HER2 is negative, but it's PD-L1 positive, then we do chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab or nivolumab or tislelizumab. So chemotherapy plus immunotherapy in general. If the HER2 is negative and the PD-L1 is negative, we look at another biomarker, the fourth one, which is called Claudin 18.2. If the Claudin 18.2 is positive, then we do chemotherapy plus a drug against the Claudin 18.2, which is called zolbetuximab. It's a new drug. Zolbetuximab is spelled as ZOLBETUXIMAB. So as you can see, these are the four main biomarkers. In addition to that, in general, we recommend to do another testing called next generation sequencing, which is really testing the cancer itself for many gene mutations. Usually, and a lot of times, it's more than 500 gene mutations to look at any other targets. But the four main ones we talked about are MMR, PD-L1, HER2, and Claudin 18.2. So as you can imagine, you know, if you have five patients coming in into the clinic today in 2025, we might treat one patient with chemo, one patient with immunotherapy, one patient with chemo plus immunotherapy, and the other is with another regimen. So it's really that's the essence of precision medicine in 2025 for the treatment of gastric cancer. And with that, I would like to thank you for listening, and we'll take questions towards the end. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sandel. That was just an outstanding presentation, stellar. And since you're the first speaker, you've really set the stage for today's program, so I really want to thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Matthew Richard Strickland, and Dr. Strickland is medical oncologist, Massachusetts General Brigham Cancer Institute, instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Strickland will be addressing the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, controlling treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, pain, and quality of life concerns, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, follow-up appointments, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Strickland.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction. And I want to say that was an expert summary by Dr. Sonbal. It's really a pleasure to join everyone that's tuned in. And as mentioned, I'm at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and I see patients predominantly with cancers of the stomach or the esophagus. To begin to speak to the role of clinical trials, this is a somewhat of a broad topic, and we're going to break it down. The ideal treatment option for any given patient, whether it's gastric cancer or another form of cancer, is something that will either take the disease away, control the disease for a very long time, make the patient feel better. And if they are having symptoms at baseline before they start treatment, either eradicate those symptoms or improve them to a point that they're tolerable and a patient is enjoying a high quality of life. So this is in the ideal setting, and this is basically what we endeavor to work towards with any given new therapy that's coming down the pipeline. So allow me to try to break that down a little bit further. When there is a new target and a therapy that's developed that appears like it could be promising to shut that target down in gastric cancer, usually this is coming from work that's been done in the laboratory, usually with cell lines or even animal studies. There needs to be some threshold of data produced that underscores this is a promising avenue to study further. And what this would then lend to is designing a phase one clinical trial. We often describe phase one as first in human. And sometimes it's not always obvious to someone that's stepping into this world what the goals of the phase one trial are. Safety is paramount. Often a new drug will be started at a relatively low dose. And it's actually priority number one that this is safe as it's introduced into a small human population. And second to that, we begin to ask the question of whether this is effective. I want to emphasize that because that priority of number one and two isn't always obvious to patients. Usually a phase one trial is conducted at a single institution, although that's not absolutely the rule. And as I said before, a small group. Any patient enrolling on a clinical trial will typically have a busier schedule than compared to if they're not on a clinical trial. And usually there's a broad team, not only of physicians, but nurses, nurse practitioners, and other really important teammates. If a drug is proved to be safe and may or may not have evidence of being effective at the phase one level, again, underscoring that this is a promising avenue to further develop, a phase two trial generally follows suit. A phase two trial generally is defined as still a relatively small group of patients, often at a single institution, but can definitely begin expanding to multiple institutions at the phase two level. And generally speaking, this is when the priority number one of the study is to begin to evaluate whether the cancer is effectively being treated. Generally, there is enough safety data from the phase one level that we can now turn our attention to, is this effectively treating the cancer? And so many tertiary academic centers offer phase one and phase two trials. And if you're going to a comprehensive cancer care center, I do think this is an important consideration for any new patient or family member for that matter. That stepping into this world, the question should be posed to the clinician, what clinical trial options do you have? And so continuing the development of a new promising therapy, if there is a promising signal from phase two level study, then it is generally now time to move this drug into a phase three study. Phase three study significantly increases the size of the patient population that's enrolled and nearly always is involved at multiple institutions, usually across countries and often across the globe. A phase three level study is looking to really prove that a drug is better than whatever standard of care is designed as the control arm. And if that superiority is proven, again, along with tolerability, then at the phase three level, this is often what leads to approval by regulatory authorities. Here in the U.S., of course, that's the FDA. Often what was once experimental therapy is now standard of care. I would point out that Dr. Sonbal introduced the drug zolbetuximab. I think that is a great example of the combination of the chemotherapy backbone and zolbetuximab, which targets claudin 18.2, was really an experimental therapy prior to October of 2024. But it was not one, but two global randomized phase three trials that ultimately showed superiority of this regimen in the right circumstance, and then culminated in FDA approval around October of 2024. And so now any patient coming to the clinic with a tumor that has strong claudin expression, they could be offered what is now standard of care because of this work at various levels of clinical trials. And then I want to finish the progression here. A phase four clinical trial often is conducted after regulatory approval of a new medicine. And this is, in a sense, confirming that what we learned at the phase three level is actually playing out in a larger population after approval the way we would have predicted. And so that's an important confirmatory phase of testing. I hope that shines a light on, in general terms, the drug development process and why we use phases at, you know, basically in different numbers and different levels. Next, I want to begin to speak to some exciting aspects that are changing rapidly. And what I mean by that is the increasing integration of technology. I think telehealth and telemedicine, it was around before the pandemic, but the pandemic certainly accelerated the use of this clinical tool, basically out of necessity. Now, we've made a lot of strides since the quote-unquote pandemic, but I think this technology is here to stay, and it's a very exciting area to discuss, consider, how is this helping? What are some of the challenges that remain? Maybe I could start with some specifics. I think it's obvious to most folks who have ever had a telemedicine visit with a clinician that, generally speaking, you need a good internet connection. You need a phone or perhaps a laptop that's going to provide that secure connection in a way that protects health information. Sometimes this can be challenging depending on who the patient is, who the family member is, and some special considerations might be needed. I think for patients and families coming into any telehealth visit, having a prepared list of questions is always going to help. There's been a lot of research done on how a patient and their respective clinician can enter into the encounter with a slightly different priority list of what they view to be important. And in a perfect world, they're completely aligned, but we know, you know, in the real world that there can be a little bit of misalignment. Preparing a list of the questions that's most important to the patient and family will hopefully guarantee that each of those items is satisfactorily addressed. A critical component to ending a telehealth visit is being clear on what comes next. And I think that this is really the responsibility of the clinician and their team to be very clear about when the next point of contact is and how that's going to be scheduled. This might happen automatically through the patient software that a particular institution institution uses. Ours, for example, is called Patient Gateway, but of course there are different names for it. Or perhaps the clinician staff will call. And so a patient should leave every visit clear on what the next step is. This brings me to the final point of how has the role of open notes changed care and changed the patient experience? Just so everybody is clear, the idea of open notes is that each patient and their family members have access to the clinical note that their doctor generates. This, in terms of research and the data, has really led to an overwhelming positive response. It's a concept that, frankly, from the get-go, it's not clear if it would have had an overall positive response or perhaps may have led to confusion or even anxiety if a patient is trying to decipher something at a medical language level. But what the data has shown us now with years of experience is that there's an overwhelmingly positive experience, both on the patient's part as well as the clinician's part. I do think that it leads to greater understanding and greater empowerment on the part of the patient for guiding their care, understanding what's happening right now, and then having the opportunity, being empowered to bring up questions if something isn't clear, or perhaps if a priority was missed and not fully addressed by the clinician or their team. So open notes is a really, I think, exciting opportunity that undoubtedly will continue to evolve as we move forward. I want to touch on one potential drawback that I see in my clinical practice and experience. Often oncologists have a very close relationship with their patients. I think that's a safe statement to make. What I find is that when scan reports are being made available and sent to patients prior to my ability to meet with them and to take them through what is significant, what is less significant, and how we're interpreting it overall, this can lead to sometimes a great deal of anxiety. I try my best to emphasize with patients that, look, this is your right as the patient. You can take a look prior to our meeting. We can talk as soon as we know that it's available. And I find that everyone's different. Some patients need to look and interpret on their own. That allows them to bring questions to our visit. On the other hand, some patients say, look, I'm not going to look. I really want to wait until my visit. I know that you will have had the ability to not only get the general radiologist's read, but also to have discussed it at what we call tumor board or our multidisciplinary imaging review. And frankly, that is what I do as an oncologist. Not only do I take into account the general radiologist's read, I look at the scan myself, but I bring nearly all scans to our expert gastric cancer specific radiologist, and I often learn more than I could have gathered from those first two measures. And so sometimes it does take more time than simply that first read being available to be able to provide the final answer of in terms of interpretation to my patient. So that's one potential challenge. It can certainly be navigated, but I do want to comment that overall, I think open notes is a step in the right direction towards patient empowerment, which culminates in partnership between the patient and the treating providers. And so I do think that brings my time to an end, but I look forward to questions and speaking more during the program. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Strickland. That was just a stellar, excellent report, excellent presentation, and just lots of great information for our participants. And I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian. And she is with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential in tolerance to treatment and to your quality of life. Your diet might be modified throughout your cancer treatment to assist with managing any side effects, such as decreased appetite, reflux indigestion, early satiety, which is when you feel full quickly, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, or weight loss, just to name a few. A dietitian can provide your individual calorie, protein, and fluid needs, and they can also give you information on how to modify your diet to help you tolerate eating better. Each person responds to treatment differently. We need you to communicate changes you're experiencing with us so we can help you as soon as possible. The goal is for you to meet your nutrition goals to avoid any significant weight loss. Weight loss can actually result in the loss of lean muscle mass, which can impact your ability to be independent. It can increase your risk of falls. Also, you can have struggles with weakness and just feeling less enthusiastic and energetic. It can also impact wound healing and even delay treatment sometimes. Even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. When your nutrition needs are not met, your body uses protein or muscle instead of fat for energy. And so this is why we have this loss of the lean muscle mass. Now, if you're struggling with eating by mouth, your treatment plan may include a feeding tube. But don't look at this as anything, as a bad, intervention, or people get very unsure about the feeding tube, but really it's part of your treatment, just as radiation, chemotherapy, surgery is. So it's just another way to nourish your body. There are medications to help with side effects, and so please let your healthcare team know when things are coming up. The sooner, the better. We don't want you to be uncomfortable any longer than you may already be. And so letting us know can help us help you sooner. Now, hydration is something we forget about oftentimes, but dehydration is very common. Most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid per day. Being dehydrated can actually amplify a lot of symptoms, such as headaches, nausea, dizziness. And so making sure you're taking enough hydration in is very important. In closing, there are several members of your healthcare team, and we're all dedicated to you. Please know how to reach each one of us and what our role is in your care. With that, I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Baird. And that was just a wonderful presentation, full of wonderful tips for people in terms of eating hints, as well as nutrition hints and nutrition and hydration tips as well. Very important. A lot of people forget that they need to drink water during your treatment as well. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Stacy Hirschman. And Ms. Hirschman is a part organization on today's program. She's Executive Director of the Gastric Cancer Foundation. And she'll be addressing Gastric Cancer Foundation's national free programs and services. And she'll also talk about the clinical trial finder and also information that they have on their wonderful website. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Hirschman.
Thank you, Carolyn. And thank you, everyone, presenters and attendees, for being part of today's workshop. The Gastric Cancer Foundation is always proud to partner with Cancer Care on these sessions. I really do learn something new and important each time we hold these workshops, and I find it so encouraging to be reminded that progress is being made and new treatment options are becoming available. There's hope, and there's growing hope, and that's a really important part of this cancer journey. I could spend hours talking about the work of my foundation, but I won't. We want to make sure there's time for your questions. So I'll just take a couple of minutes to highlight a few of the things that we do at the Gastric Cancer Foundation, and particularly things that are available and that might be of help directly to you. Our website is easy to find. It's gastriccancer.org, and it's the gateway to everything. First, I want you to know that we have a strong commitment to research. And we've granted over $4 million to promising projects. I don't have time to tell you everything we do in this realm, but I want to spotlight two things. First, if you are a patient or a close family member, please check out the Gastric Cancer Registry. You can help advance knowledge and accelerate progress by sharing your experience and possibly a tissue sample from surgery you've already had or a saliva sample. You'll be supporting scientists all around the world who are working to discover better diagnostics and treatments. If you go on our website, you'll see how to contact the registry team, and they can answer all your questions. Second, as Carolyn mentioned, we offer a free, confidential, and unbiased clinical trials finder tool to help patients and families learn about open trials that match with your individual condition. Why? Because, as Dr. Strickland said, trials are the singular path for approving and making new treatments available. And while advancing research, trial participants may be able to access the newest advances now. I encourage you to check it out. You can do your own search online, or you can speak with a trained navigator by phone who will provide individualized assistance. Information really can be powerful. We offer a lot of other resources. Our website is that hub of information and links. A couple of things I'll mention. One is we offer a safe online community exclusively for patients and caregivers. You can ask questions, share information, and have candid, confidential conversations with other people who understand this disease firsthand. There's no obligation, so I hope you'll take a look. I want to mention a brand new video project that we recently launched called Your New Normal. In these videos, we will have conversations with patients and expert resources about aspects of the cancer journey that can be difficult to acknowledge, much less discuss. Our first episode, entitled Your Fears and Emotions, is available on our website now. It presents a frank and insightful conversation about the onslaught of feelings and fears, the grief that naturally accompanies this diagnosis, and suggests ways that you might be able to cope and also find sources of support. Your mental and emotional well-being are key to your physical well-being. And finally, our well-known nutrition support series, which is called Gesundheit Kitchen, is a great resource for patients and families who want tips on how to live and even enjoy eating after treatment, and most important, to get the nutrition you need. I really encourage you to visit our website and take a look. Hans Ruffert, who is a gastric cancer survivor and a professional chef, joins with a licensed dietitian to present short episodes. Hans knows the challenges firsthand, and I think you'll appreciate the spirit, the humor, and the optimism with which he approaches life and each episode. Everything is archived on our website. So let me wrap up, as I always do, by saying no one needs to face this diagnosis alone, and I don't believe anyone should try. I hope you'll check out our website and take advantage of the support and the resources that are available. Thank you, and Carolyn, handing it back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Christian. That was just a superb presentation, stellar, and so many resources at the Gastric Cancer Foundation. We are honored to partner with you on these programs. You bring just a wealth of support and information and recipes for people in terms of how to adapt. I think this is, and they're wonderful recipes by a superb chef, so, and the trial finder. So there's so much on that website. I definitely recommend that that should be your go-to place when you have gastric cancer, definitely, or a loved one has gastric cancer. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization, and we provide online services as well as I have a website, so I'm letting you know a little bit about what we do. So many people contact Cancer Care in the United States on our HOPE line, 1-800-813-4673. By calling this number, you're connected immediately to one of our oncology social workers, and they will help you to get, you know, to access the services that you need. People often call with a specific question, like, I'd like to join an online support group, or I need help with transportation to treatment. You know, and basically, we do have online support groups for people with gastric cancer and for caregivers also. We also, and those are all free. Also, we do also help you with clinical trials. We have clinical trialists, which helps you find clinical trials for your particular type of cancer, which is gastric cancer in this instance. And we also have what we call a PAW program. It's a program for people who may have a pet and they're just not feeling well enough to either change the litter box or take their dog for a walk. And so we have that service as well. So visit our website for a full listing of all the programs that we offer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Audra to explain to you how to queue up for online questions. Audra?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And a question for Dr. Sonval. What do you do when FLOT, F-L-O-T, doesn't work?
Thank you. Yeah. So FLOT is usually a name of chemotherapy. It's a combination of three main chemotheraphies, 5-FU, oxaliplatin, and docetaxel. And it's usually, when it's usually used with an intention of going into surgery afterwards. I'm not sure I can answer the question specifically to this case, but in general, we have to really be careful to when we say it when it's not working, because the intention of FLOT is not to eradicate the cancer. Usually we do 2 months of FLOT and then we do the PET scan again. And then if the cancer has not spread, then we go and do the surgery. Sometimes we do additional chemo, but usually we go and have the surgery. So the fact that, for example, on the PET scan, the follow-up PET scan after the 2 months of FLOT, the fact that the cancer stayed the same, that does not mean that the FLOT doesn't work or didn't work. It's extremely rare for the cancer to spread outside the stomach while on FLOT. It can happen, but it's very rare, and that would be the failure of the FLOT. And if that happens, then the patient should have a discussion with their oncologist of what to do next, because there are other chemotherapies that can be utilized. Now, sometimes, especially if the cancer is in the junction between the stomach and the esophagus, and if the FLOT was used for example, 2 months, and then we do scans again, and we see that there is not really much of a change, and sometimes, that's not common, but sometimes the surgeon might be worried about, for example, getting negative margins or something like that. So at Tumor Board, we've done it in the past where we would consider chemoradiation. Again, that's mainly in the GE junction and very highly selected cases. Of note, for up to just last year, the standard of care for gastroesophageal junction cancers was really chemoradiation or FLOT. Now we tend to do more and more FLOT rather than chemoradiation. But going back to the question, I think first we have to clarify what is meant by FLOT didn't work, and then kind of go from there. And that decision, again, I always emphasize about the tumor board input, because that's very important.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Question for Dr. Strickland. What resources do you recommend for clinical trials? What are my options if I don't live near a cancer center?
Thank you for that question. We heard a great resource today. So whether it is the Gastric Cancer Foundation or other patient advocacy organizations, with the help of, simply typing it into a search engine on the internet, I would say look at these various foundations and patient advocacy organizations, and there's clinical trial finder tools like the one that was mentioned before. I think that is probably the fallback when you cannot easily get to a large tertiary care center and or a comprehensive cancer care center. Fundamentally, at the time of the visit with the oncologist, I would hope that all oncologists can then introduce to their patient what standard of care looks like, and then what clinical trial options that, even if it's not being offered at that center, that they know about, and where the shortest distance to one of those options might be. That's my hope. I do think that's a responsibility of the oncologist. So those are a few thoughts for that excellent question.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Strickland. And a question for Dr. Sanval. What are the guidelines for genetic testing when more than one family member has been diagnosed with gastric cancer? At what age should screening start?
Yeah, I think if there is any hint of a family history, I would definitely do genetic testing. I do have a very low threshold of doing genetic testing. I mentioned briefly that hereditary aspects are important. There are some syndromes of inheriting specific genes and giving it to other family members, such as, Lynch syndrome, CDH1 mutations, and things like that. We've looked at it, and other groups have looked at it as well, and in our experience, it was almost about 15-20% of patients with stomach cancer have some genetic component that make them higher risk of this cancer. So I usually get a family history, and whenever I see any family history of whether stomach cancer or other cancers, sometimes it might manifest with other cancers. For example, CDH1 mutation can manifest in female and males as gastric cancer, but in females it can manifest as lobular breast cancer, special type of breast cancer. Also, when I hear, there is ovarian cancer or uterine cancer, prostate cancer, I think of BRCA. With BRCA also can increase the risk of gastric cancer. So to answer the question, I would have a very low threshold of any family history of cancers to get genetic testing done. Most of the genetic testing are actually, the testings are covered by insurance, and usually the companies that are being sent to do the genetic testing, most of the times they run it through insurance, and if the insurance is not covering for some reason or another, they discuss with the patient the out-of-pocket. If the patient is concerned about the financial aspects, they can always have their oncologist first sent to a genetic counselor who would do the counseling and then do the genetic testing. So it can be done either way. The oncologist send it directly, or they do the consultation, whatever the oncologist and the patient is comfortable with.
Excellent. Thank you. And question for Dr. Sanval. Are there increasing rates of gastric cancer in younger populations? If so, who is most at risk?
Unfortunately, we are seeing more and more cancers in general in the AYA population, or adolescents and young adults, defined as, depending on the study you look at, but it's usually people who are younger than 50 in general, or 45. The challenge is really to kind of find out why. Now, this trend of increase in the diagnosis is mainly seen in other GI cancers, but also in the stomach cancer, there is a hint of an increased incidence as well in the younger population. What are the causes? It's very unclear. I mean, there are some speculations about the fact of, the diet changes in general is a risk factor. We know that diet is very strongly related to gastric cancer. I mentioned how salt preservation before, a long time ago, was associated with gastric cancer, and using refrigeration decreased that risk. Now we know from multiple studies that processed food actually is associated with increased stomach cancer. So all of these aspects, I think environmental aspects and other aspects are contributing to the increased incidence that we're seeing. Unfortunately, I do have multiple patients, not one or two, but multiple patients in my clinic, and they are in their 30s and 40s with stomach cancer.
Thank you so much. For Dr. Strickland, will treatment for gastric adenocarcinoma differ based on where it's located in the stomach?
Yeah, this is a great question. What I would start by saying is that we know from a couple of large studies that looked at the genetics of what drives cancer happening in the esophagus, the gastroesophageal junction, and the stomach. And we do know that the underlying genetics and the subgroup in terms of the genetics that's making a cancer tick can differ based on location. But this fact fails to translate into treatment decisions except for one category only, which Dr. Sonball introduced to us. That subgroup is called tumors with defective mismatch repair, also known as MSI high. But so that will impact treatment decisions. But the point I'm trying to make is, rather than location, it's really much more important to be aware of biomarkers, conventional biomarkers. Again, expertly introduced by Dr. Sonball, I would say there's four conventional. We have more coming down the pipeline. That accounts for much more of the treatment decision-making than the underlying location. The final point is that there used to be some differences based on closer to the esophagus versus closer to the true stomach, but these differences are shrinking over time with a general trend of similar treatment paradigms, regardless of esophagus, junction, and stomach.
Excellent, thank you so much. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway for each of you. I'm going to start with Dr. Sonball, just a takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program.
Of course, yeah. No, thank you everyone for listening. And my takeaway is, again, that there is definitely hope. Things are getting better. And I can tell you, as I mentioned, I've been fortunate to be part of this program to participate in the last at least 4 years. And I can tell you, when I first participated in this back in 2021, I think, definitely the things were available at that time are not available. The things that were available at that time, they were not available before. And the things that are available now, they were not available at that time. So we have more and more options available than before. And that's what keeps us going to kind of work with the patients along with their family members and other team members to kind of get to better therapies for patients to reach the and get to the optimal and ultimate goal, which is to cure this cancer.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Strickland?
One of my major takeaways, I think, is the theme of partnership between the oncologist and a patient / family. I would say there's never been a bigger role to continue to build a stronger partnership. And some modern facts that support that would be the capability for telehealth visits. We discussed open notes. So now patients and families can see exactly in writing what their clinician is thinking. But beyond those elements that we talked about, just the fact that we're here on this call is a perfect example of there's never been a greater opportunity for partnership between clinicians and other, whether it's oncologists or other clinicians, and the patients. And through collaboration with patient advocacy organizations and foundations, I think that we can ask the right research questions, we can push investment in the right directions, and together we can move the needle in terms of outcomes for our patients living with gastric cancer.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Ms. Hershen.
Well, I'm so encouraged by what Dr. Strickland just said, and I think it's such an important message of, as a patient, you are an important member of your own treatment team. And we encourage you to be an active member of your own treatment team. I also would say that one of the takeaways is that you're not just a patient, you're a person. And so I encourage everyone to take care of yourself in the broadest terms possible and seek the help that's available.
Excellent, thank you. And I just want to add that I think it's been said that please know that you're not alone, that you're now part of a community of support. And we will be sending you a SurveyMonkey evaluation in about a week after the program. And then it's an evaluation of the program, but we also will include all the references that we mentioned today. And you have the Gastric Cancer Foundation, you have Cancer Care, there are many other organizations out there. But certainly the Gastric Cancer Foundation is really your go-to place for any of the concerns that you may have. Now, I do want to, in concluding, I just want to say a few words. But those of you who had a chance to ask a question, please also take your question back to your treating healthcare team, because remember, they know you the best. They have your records in front of them. And be sure that you, and you've learned a lot, so be sure to take your questions back to your treating healthcare team, and be sure to ask the question of your healthcare team. And for those of you who are queuing up for a question, didn't get a chance to ask a question, again, take your question back to your healthcare team and ask them the question. Remember, you've all learned a lot from today's program. There's been a lot of information that's come your way, and you want to be sure to make the most use of it. Also, I do want to remind all of you that it seems that many of our patients tell us that weekends, holidays, and evenings are the hardest time to reach their healthcare team. So always be sure to find out what number you should call evenings, weekends, and holidays. That's really very important. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. You've been an extraordinary group. This has been an extraordinary call. Great questions, great speakers. It's been phenomenal. And I want to thank you all for your participation today and wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.